You know, I titled this The Smell of Burning Popcorn. I used to work in a movie theater, and one of the things you take away from that is, for one thing, the smell of popcorn generally just permeates everything. But that by itself isn't necessarily objectionable. But burnt popcorn, on the other hand, I don't know many people who find that anything other than a really gross, unpleasant smell. And when you go home and it's in your hair and, you know, it just, it's in everything. That's how the situation has been with us when it comes to the sharp increase in RFEs, you know, that's been alluded to. It, for us, has really changed the way that we need to approach cases from the very beginning of the case. You know, even when we're dealing with what should be a straightforward, uncomplicated H-1B, you know, so the first thing that I would say that's been important to us is to set the expectations appropriately. And that's true even for me. You know, I'm not dealing with clients that pay me. You know, they're stuck with me whether they want to or not. But from the beginning, telling them, you know, we're going to get, most likely, because the majority of H-1B cases are getting requests for additional evidence, we're probably going to get a request for evidence. It's going to be lengthy, and it's going to have some questions that you struggle to understand why any intelligent person would be asking this. And it will probably involve me asking you some very bureaucratic, inapplicable to anyone with common sense questions. But that's just what's going to happen in all likelihood, so be prepared. Not that anyone's ever happy to get the RFE, but I do find that I get a lot less trouble from folks when they're prepared from the beginning to expect that that's going to be the case. And for the cases we do with premium processing, I've also taken to cautioning them about what those requests are going to say, because many times they'll have boilerplate language on there saying, oh, you know, when you submit the response to us, please give us, you know, 60 days to process the thing. And, you know, that tends to freak people out because they're wondering, why did we spend this extra money if they're going to take that long anyway? Never mind the fact that it's still dramatically shorter than the timetable you would see with a regular processing case. But, you know, that I do find helps to avoid as much of a shock. We're also paying much more careful attention to how we put together those initial filings, what we include, what we do not include. You know, and it's not that we were ever just sort of recklessly throwing it together and seeing what happens. But it, in a lot of ways, our process at the beginning has come to resemble more what you would see at the outset of a perm case. And I'll talk a little bit more about that in a minute. But, you know, really looking at, okay, what's this document? Do we need to have it in there? Is it something that we maybe don't want to include? You know, sometimes I think there's a tendency to think, okay, the client gave me all these documents of their education and certificates and stuff. Let's just throw it all in there because the more the better, right? And I don't think that's necessarily true. You know, sometimes if you're putting in perfect attendance certificates and things like that, you know, if anything, it's going to make them wonder why you felt the need to put that in there. So I don't see a whole lot to gain, and I try to make sure that we've carefully selected each and every piece that goes in there. And although this hasn't been directly true with us, because we don't, like most academic institutions, we're not particularly litigious, I do think it's important for anybody working in these cases to prepare with the possibility of future litigation in mind. You know, you've heard some good discussion about litigation, and I think that's something, you know, you go back 5 or 10 years, you weren't going to find all that many people spending a lot of time and effort on it. But I think there's good reason to think that in some of these cases that may be necessary, and it may be the best way to solve whatever headache you've got. Not always, but I do think to that end, you know, prepared in mind, keeping in, you know, prepare from the beginning, keeping in mind the possibility that this evidence may go forward before, you know, a judge, somebody like a real judge, someone who actually is going to give it a rational look and recognize when you have submitted strong, compelling evidence, even if it's things that the government has decided for whatever reason to not pay the closest attention to or give the greatest weight to it. All right. So, whose form is it anyway? You know, once upon a time, the principal concern that I think many of us would have had with the LCA was, you know, technical problems getting it submitted to Department of Labor. You know, those rare cases, those rare situations where they were having, you know, outages of ICERT or drawn a blank on what the predecessor to ICERT was. But, you know, situations where suddenly you couldn't print an LCA that you needed to send on a cap case, and you'd have to print up whatever notice, you know, AILA managed to get out of them saying, you know, do a screenshot or something like that. It was things like that. We weren't, and we would be concerned with making sure that we were paying careful attention to process it in a way that would protect against any risk of back wage liability by choosing an inappropriately low prevailing wage. It was not something that I expected to be discussing at any length with USCIS. But I think we've certainly seen under the current administration that they are taking a great deal of interest in issues that center around the LCA.